part of a study panel of the National Academy of Engineering. And we'll hear from Charles Vest, the president of the National Academy, William Perry, the head of the study group, Calestous Juma from Harvard University, who is one of the panelists, and Ray Kurzweil is delayed, but probably will be here momentarily, we hope. And I will turn it over to Dr. Vest.
Thank you very much. As we all know, 20th century engineering profoundly enabled life, work, and learning as we know it today. The issue now is, what about the future? To attempt to get a vector on this, the National Academy of Engineering appointed a committee of truly amazingly accomplished and innovative individuals to think about what some of the great challenges of the 21st century are that could be solved by engineering together with science and medicine, and to lay these challenges out before us. We asked that these be things that were visionary and terribly important to human life, but that also were assumed to be doable with the right influx of work and resources over the next few decades. The results are 14 grand challenges, unranked, that you will hear about today. Some of these, meeting some of these, is simply imperative to our survival on this planet. Some will make us more secure against both human and natural threats, and all would improve the quality of life in our nation and world. If I could just make a quick observation, in the last century, we were quite stovepiped. Scientists discovered, engineers created, and medical doctors healed. In the 21st century, science, engineering, and medicine are totally interdependent and are blending together in new ways. So for that and other reasons, as you hear these grand challenges, you will recognize that 21st century engineering is not going to be a static undertaking. It's going to advance, and it's going to change in a very organic and relatively rapid way. Before Dr. Perry takes over to lead things here, I just wanted to mention what some of the things the National Academy of Engineering hopes to accomplish with this work. First of all, we hope that it will form the basis of a wider promotion of the understanding of the critical importance of engineering advances to our lives and our prosperity. We hope to explain that, as I said earlier, meeting some of these challenges will actually be necessary to sustain human life on our planet. Most important, we hope to inspire, to use it to help us inspire a new generation of young men and women to go into fields like engineering to help prepare a path, to help engineer a path toward a more desirable and sustainable future. And finally, we hope that these will be a mechanism for helping to explain to politicians that effective governing and world leadership in the 21st century will profoundly depend on advancing and utilizing the knowledge and the tools of science, engineering, and medicine. And with that bit of an overview, it's my pleasure to turn things over to Bill Perry.
Thank you, Chuck. At the end of the 20th century, the National Academy of Engineering convened a panel of experts to reflect on the engineering achievements of that remarkable century. The Academy report that resulted describes an amazing, truly an amazing set of achievements. Just think for a moment, the automobile, the aircraft, the jet aircraft, the rocket, the missiles, the satellites, radio, radar, television, nuclear power, nuclear weapons, computer, the internet, genetic engineering, antibiotics. These are just the highlights. It's an incredible list of achievements. They gave us the Green Revolution, the distribution of safe water and electricity, improved health, increase in population, and improved standard of living. That's the good news. But those remarkable achievements also had a dark side. And that dark side we are facing in the 21st century. The depletion of energy resources, a looming global environmental disaster, a looming security disaster if the incredibly destructive levels of power that now exist fall into the hands of terrorists, and the emergence of drug-resistant pathogens. So when our panel came together to decide how we were going to approach the problems of the 21st century, we said we should not only look at the how we seize the opportunities from new technology, but how we meet the challenges that were created by the developments in the 20th century. So with this in mind, we organized a report on the needs of society and how technology can meet those needs. So instead of going from technology to needs, we went from needs to how technology might deal with those needs. That was a fundamental decision we made in our first meeting, which completely dictated how we approached the problems. In the challenges, one of the major challenges was the depletion of energy resources. And as we considered that, we highlighted two especially promising new sources of energy, nuclear fusion and deriving electricity from fusion, which we thought could be done in the medium term, and more efficient solar arrays, which could be done perhaps in the near term. But even if those developments proceed faster than most optimistic of us imagine, we're still going to be burning carbon fuels for decades to come. And therefore, we focused also on ways of reducing the environmental damage done by burning carbon fuels, the most obvious of which is carbon sequestration. So that is another looming engineering challenge of the 21st century. How do we get carbon sequestration practical and reasonably cost efficient? A related problem is managing the nitrogen cycle better. The nitrogen that we use all aspects of life today, but particularly in farming life, also causes its own kind of pollution. And there's a whole host of technologies, most of them available near term, which will deal with that problem. We looked at the problem of dealing with nuclear terrorism and concluded that the first and the most important action is preventing the terrorists from getting their hands on a nuclear weapon or fissile material in the first place. Achieving that goal is primarily a political problem, not a technical problem. But technical developments in the areas of detection and monitoring can facilitate political solutions to that problem. In the area of biological terrorism, we did not believe it feasible to keep the pathogens out of the hands of terrorists, and therefore we are focused on the rapid response in dealing with a biological attack. And that led us to the need for cheap and sensitive detectors so that this rapid response, which is necessary, could be achieved. It is a big plus here that if we develop those quickly and adequately and apply them adequately, they will also be exactly the same technical needs and administrative needs that will be useful in dealing with a pandemic. The problem of dealing with drug-resistant pathogens. We regarded one of the more serious issues today, but we also had considerable hope that genetic engineering would lead us to new and more effective ways of dealing with that problem. And then finally, there's a problem of dealing with the shortage of pure water as our population increases. Here we see low-cost, large-scale programs in desalinization, as well as small-scale, village-sized technical devices for filtering water. Now, these are a set of the things that can and should be done and with technology to deal with these emerging problems. But beyond that, there are new technologies that are going to be developed that will allow us to seize opportunities. Very high on that list is realizing the full potential of developments already started in the 20th century but not yet mature: the computer, the internet, and genetic engineering. That revolution, which started in the 20th century, could be developed and matured in the first half of the 21st century. It could lead us, for example, to greatly improved health informatics. We treat in medical treatment today, the computer is conceptually can play an important role, but in fact does not. And so the opportunity to make a large-scale application of computers and what we would call health informatics looms as one important application. In the educational field, two quite different approaches we looked at. One is the concept of personalized teaching. For example, the development of what is called recommender systems. I think of them as tutoring computers, which I would reflect that in the last 3 decades, computers have been proposed as a way of improving education, but have had have not really met their promise. I think this is an idea, however, whose time, I believe, has come, and we're going to see near-term very important applications of computers in education, primarily in the field of computer-based tutors. Now, beyond that, there's a large-scale access to information manifested already by the Google system. But as we speak, Google is now working to digitize major libraries at universities in the world. And we're going to have available access to information of much of the literature, much of the scientific, much of the history of the world available to us at the touch of a finger, just as we now have with the Google system. Beyond personalized education, there's personalized medicine. Genetic engineering allows us to exploit the gene mapping to determine more precisely what ailments are and how they should be treated. So it opens up the possibility of targeted drugs that are narrowly targeted based on a precise diagnosis of the pathogen and of the patient. Another area that has not met its promise in the last few decades is artificial intelligence. The approach is now being taken in the field of artificial intelligence, which could be called reverse engineering of the brain, opens up the possibility of really significant and important applications of artificial intelligence in the near future. It also, as we go in this direction, it also opens up the possibility of not only faster computers, but the treatment of neurological disorders as we gain a better understanding of the brain, including the ability to simulate functions of the brain. Finally, I want to comment that there is besides dealing with problems and treating disease, there's the problem of expanding the human spirit. Expanding the human potential. Some areas of research will lead to answering the question, who are we? That is, expanding the human consciousness. And others will answer the question, where are we? Understanding more about the universe in which we live. Those are all the exciting prospects open for us as we enter this 21st century. Technology will play a key and important role. The achievements at the end of the 21st century, look back at it, I believe the achievements will be just as spectacular as they were at the 20th century, with the hopes that we have also learned how to make more applications of this technology that are more useful to society.
Good. Thank you. I just wanted to add a few comments on this, which is that these advances are being developed in the context of a much more enlightened public understanding of the role of engineering in society, or science and technology in general. And therefore, we've been very interested in exploring the public policy implications of focusing on these grand challenges. And I just wanted to highlight three of these. The first is the fact that this idea is being developed in the context of a globalized world. Even though the proposals are being developed in the United States, the challenges themselves that humanity faces are global in character. If you take, say, the current debates on global warming, that any technological solutions that are developed to address those problems have to be addressed in the context of a global community rather than just national initiatives. And therefore, we think that these technologies provide a basis for enhanced international cooperation in addressing global issues. That's one area that we think, in terms of public policy concerns, are related. We need to think carefully about. I think the debate on advances in genetics, especially in regard to genetically modified foods, have clearly indicated that, assured us that you cannot only address these as national issues, especially where the products have a global appeal. The second area that I think it's equally important is thinking about the public perceptions in terms of how society responds to new technologies. Again, we've seen major debates, especially around nanotechnology, that indicate that when we are developing new technologies, we need to take into account how the public might react to those new technologies, and that's an area that we're particularly very interested in. And finally, the critical role of engineering in promoting human welfare in the developing countries. This is a very, very specific area, particularly in regard to Africa and areas like infrastructure development, for example. This is an area that's linked to the first point about the globalization of engineering capabilities, but it's a very specific area on how to include countries that have previously been excluded from the benefits of advances in the engineering sciences. Those are three areas that I think that in terms of a global public policy debate, we are likely to see a greater interest in a better understanding of how advances in the technical fields relate to societal factors. In this case, the point about global inclusion, secondly, public perceptions of new technologies, and thirdly, how to address issues related to those countries that have previously been excluded from technology, mostly the poorest of the developing world. I just wanted to highlight those as a kind of policy questions that we expect will emerge as we continue to discuss these challenges. I have sensed, just on the basis of discussions with colleagues around the world, that we are going to see, in fact, other countries emulate this report and start to develop kind of follow-up reports as well. And I think that as follow-up reports get developed, we are going to see greater interest in focusing on the interface between engineering and society as an important part of the debate. So thank you again.
Okay, thank you. I should mention there are some other members of the study committee in the room that might be also able to answer questions. Any questions over there?
Well, first of all, this work, in fact, was commissioned by the National Science Foundation Engineering Directorate, and they are hoping to utilize parts or perhaps all as a serious and substantial input into their thinking about strategy, future budgets, et cetera. But as I said this morning, we also very much want to use this as a basis for outreach to inspire young people to come into these fields, see what some of the challenges are, help explain to politicians broadly why it's so important to continue to invest and utilize the tools and knowledge of engineering and science and medicine. Our first foray will be the website, that's a pretty spiffy website, actually, that is up on the National Academy of Engineering for the Grand Challenges. It's highly interactive. We're going to engage people in the public in thinking about things like how would you prioritize these, what would you add, what would you subtract. So we see it largely as a communication effort, but hopefully places like NSF and the work of the Academy themselves will latch on to some of the core issues here and use them to ultimately guide real policy.
Corey?
Directly as political rather than technical challenges, yet impact on the way
she referred to Bill Wolf's use of the term the ecology of innovation and wondered how you see this as feeding into that national ecology for innovation.
I believe that besides actually identifying specific areas that are important for development, a major contribution we hope this report makes is that it makes the connection between society needs and the developments that engineers are achieving. I think that's the most, that doesn't precisely answer your question, but that would be my reaction to it. Do you want to add anything?
Speaking with my academy hat on here, we would still look to the Augustine Committee's Rising Above the Gathering Storm as our key mechanism for pursuing the specific kind of things that Bill was talking about, including the visas and deemed exports, things you mentioned, and we will still all have our sleeves rolled up and hope that the America Competes Act gets funded in 2009.
Alan?
Quickly on the first one, all good suggestions like this are on the table. We are committed to holding one major public event around this that we have not really designed yet until we sort of see what the reaction to the material on the web is. Bill?
On the that last point that I made, which is understanding the universe, we considered a number of devices and tools for doing that. Certainly prominent among those were space probes and new instruments for space probes.
Yes. Did you understand it? What more of what is meant by reverse engineering the brain?
Oh, maybe.
Dr. Sanger would be the best qualified person to answer.
Could you tell him who you are, please?
Sure. I'm Bob Langer. I'm an associate professor at MIT.
Could you use the microphone because we're being... come on up here. Use that one right
there. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. What I'm going to do is just give you my...
No, Chuck. He was my former president, you know, so...
Former.
Well, now you're president of all the engineers. So,
tell him who you are.
Yeah, so I'm Bob Langer. I'm an institute professor at MIT. That's Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Just making sure everybody knew. So then the area, and I was on the committee, and I was involved in some of the medical aspects. I think what and I'd have to check exactly what was meant in the thing, but I think that there's a whole, possibly by reverse engineering the brain, there's areas like neural networks where people are trying to better understand, to take advances that have gone on in our understanding of the brain and to try to use that to intelligently, to take that kind of intelligence and, you know, apply it, say, to computer technology and other kinds of things so that we can make things much more efficient, just like our brain is. And so, you know, it's an area that people are still trying to understand better and better. Again, I'd have to check the exact wording that you're referring to, but that's certainly one of the areas that people were talking about. It's in neural networks.
Yeah, that's precisely what was meant by it.
If I might add, hopefully Ray Kurzweil's taxi.
Right,
here,
right, exactly. That's his area.
The write-up describes a very interesting circle. It starts by saying the advances in neuroscience that are coming so rapidly ought to be able, as Bob said, help us to design much more effective computer-based artificial intelligence systems, but also that the computing power and the ability to model and simulate can feed back into our understanding of the neuroscience and systems working of the brain. So it's sort of both ends of that spectrum.
Any other questions? Yes, here.
Yes, Karen.
Bob?
A freelancer,
Bob?
Scientific American and Scientific American Mind. My question is about enhancing virtual reality, if someone could elaborate.
So the question is about enhancing virtual reality.
We saw virtual reality advancements leading to both the use of tools and as toys. Today, it's mostly a toy. It's mostly a gee whiz sort of an application. But it can also be used in design, for example. The virtual reality, which allows the designer to imagine and to go inside the object, the very complex object he's designing, gives him a very important tool in that aspect. So we were looking, as I said, at virtual reality improvements, both in the area of the amusement and entertainment and in the area of an engineering tool.
Yes, in the back there.
I didn't hear that question.
The question was on the point of geoengineering the climate. Was there a decision not to put that on your list, or was it on your list?
I was actually asking, was it a difficult decision among the committee not to put that on the list, the idea of changing the albedo in various ways or such things?
Well, there is a fairly substantial section in the report dealing with the climate change and ways of discussing climate change and ways of dealing with those changes. I'm not quite sure more specifically what you mean by the question, though. But that issue is covered in the report.
The sort of thing that Paul Crutzen was writing about last year in climate change that Ken Goldier and Andy Bragg have been talking about recently, changing the shortwave side of the climate balance. But if it wasn't something that came up, that's kind of the answer.
Mm-hmm. I can't elaborate further on that one, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I remember discussing some things about climate change, but I think you're right. Some things were put in the report.
So. Yeah, we have a whole section on climate change.
Exactly, yeah. So I think, you know, some of it is to just give people a general idea of important areas and not mention every specific thing.
Okay.
The focus that I covered very briefly in my introductory comments was dealing with climate change several different ways. First of all, by getting energy sources which are carbon-free, and I mentioned the fusion and the solar arrays as being two primary examples of that. And secondly, by sequestering, developing efficient and economical ways of sequestering the carbon that is put into the atmosphere by burning carbon fuel. Those are the primary features there. Ray, do you want to add to that?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm late.
We welcome Ray Kurzweil, who has just arrived.
I think we should put all these engineering goals aside and just make the planes run on time. I did catch a 6 a.m. flight, but then my next flight was canceled. Larry Page and I worked extensively, along with the other members, on this energy plan, which is based on solar. And you might wonder whether there's actually enough sunlight. The reality is we have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need. If we captured one part in 10,000 of the sunlight that falls in the earth, we would meet 100% of our energy needs. We can't do that today because today's energy, solar panels, are an old industrial technology, just like fossil fuels are a 19th century technology, and they're inefficient, heavy, expensive, hard to install. There's a new generation emerging now of nano-engineered solar panels based on new properties of materials, based on engineering them at the molecular level. Some of these, in fact, have substantial investment from Google. One company that Google is invested in has a new nano-engineered material that appears like it might actually be close to competitive with fossil fuels. But regardless of any one technology, Larry and I and the other members of the panel were confident that we're not that far away from a tipping point where energy from solar will be competitive with fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are headed up. Because solar energy is an information technology, if it's engineered with nanotechnology, it's subject to what I call the law of accelerating returns, which is this doubling of price performance of information technologies every year. I personally believe that we're within 5 years of that tipping point. We also see an exponential progression in the use of solar energy. It's doubling now every 2 years. Doubling every 2 years means multiplying by 1,000 in 20 years. At that rate, we'll meet 100% of our energy needs from solar within 20 years. So one of the plans in here is, in fact, to develop that infrastructure, these new technologies, to gather efficiently, inexpensively, with lightweight solar panels, energy from the sun. We only have to capture one part in 10,000. There are other technologies that go along with that, for example, concentrators. There are already parabolic mirrors that can focus very large areas of sunlight onto a small collector or even a small, efficient steam turbine. We then need to store the energy because of the intermittency of solar energy, and so new technologies for storage, including nano-engineered fuel cells. You could, for example, create hydrogen or hydrogen-based fuels from the energy produced by solar panels and then use that to fuel to create fuel for fuel cells. There already are, in fact, fuel cells based on nanotechnology, MEMS, microelectronic mechanical system-based fuel cells that are emerging now, microscopic in size, that can be scaled up to store large amounts of energy. So that's the energy plan.
Okay.
The question is whether the question is on fusion and whether you eventually will pass the break-even point on it. Anybody care to respond?
Well, I don't think the authors of the fusion plan are here. I'd say that technology is either going to achieve that tipping point or not. I think you put your finger on the right issue. If that can be done, then energy from fusion would be incredibly plentiful and inexpensive. And because of that potential, it's worth investing in. But that is what needs to be proven and still is a matter of some scientific advance in order to achieve that tipping point.
We did not have a consensus on the panel on that issue. My own view is that will be achieved. And to get to Ray's point here, I think we will demonstrate whether it can be achieved within the next 10 years. I mean, I don't think we're that far away from having a yes or no on whether it's achievable.
But in contrast, solar is not that speculative. It has been demonstrated with small-scale solutions that solar energy can be collected much more efficiently, with efficiencies of 30, 40, or even more percent with lightweight materials that ultimately can be produced inexpensively. And it has already attracted billions of dollars of venture investment. And quite aside from the attraction of renewable energy that's clean, there's a small matter of the $2 trillion budget we spend on energy. So there's plenty of motivation, not to mention the geostrategical implications.
Other questions? Yes.
A question for Dr. Kurzweil. Given some of the predictions you've made in some of your better known books, how do they sit with some of the challenges which seem more, a continuation of the 20th century? You've obviously written about things which are really very different from the 20th century.
Well,
could you repeat the question, please?
How does it tie in with the.
How are the kind of predictions I've made in some of my writings, like the singularities near, tie in with this report? And I'd say we had a very progressive panel. Aside from myself, we had the distinguished people you see here, and we had also Dean Kamen and Larry Page and Craig Venter. And this report is very consistent with my view of progression. It's my view that only technology has the scale to address the pressing problems we have. And a key thing happens when an industry or technology goes from a pre-information era to a post-information era. And one exciting industry that's doing that right now very clearly is health and medicine. Health and medicine, up until a few years ago, was not an information technology. It was hit or miss. We'd find something. Oh, here's something that lowers blood pressure. Well, this seems to work. We don't really have a theory of operation. And invariably, these tools, drugs and other interventions, had lots of side effects. And almost all the drugs on the market were done that way. It's called drug discovery. But 4 years ago, we collected the genome, the software of life. And we've been making exponential gains in understanding it, reverse engineering it. We have the tools to reprogram that software, not just in a baby, but in a... I mean, I'm much more interested in designer baby boomers than designer babies. We can turn off genes with RNA interference, and there are 1,000 drugs in the development pipeline to turn off genes that cause disease or turn off the fat insulin receptor gene. When that was tried in animals, these animals ate a lot and remained slim. To add new genes using new forms of gene therapy, turn on and off enzymes, simulate biological processes. The interesting thing is that once this area of science and technology and this industry becomes an information technology, it's subject to what I call the law of accelerating returns, which is a doubling in power every year. You can see that in computers. When I was at MIT, we all shared one computer. It cost $11 million. This computer is 1,000,000 times smaller, 1,000,000 times cheaper, 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in price performance. We'll make another billion-fold improvement in price performance in the next 25 years. And it's not just computerized devices. The same thing happened with the Genome Project. When that was announced in 1990, that was not a mainstream project. That was a renegade project. Mainstream skeptics said, there's no way you're going to do this. We just had our best PhD students, our most advanced equipment, and around the world you collected 1/10,000th of the genome. And halfway through the project, the skeptics were still going strong, saying, I told you this wasn't going to work. Here you are 7.5 years into this 15-year project, and you finished 1% of the project. But that's actually right on schedule for an exponential progression. Double 1% 7 more times, you get 100%. The amount of genetic data we've sequenced has literally, precisely, doubled every year. The cost has come down by half every year. It was $10 in 1990 per base pair. It's a small fraction of a penny today. And this has continued past the end of the Genome Project. So health and medicine has now become an information technology, which means it'll be 1,000 times more capable in 10 years, 1,000,000 times more capable in 20 years. Energy is going to become an information technology once we move from fossil fuels, which is clearly not an information technology, to these new nano-engineered materials, which do incorporate information technology. And the report in many different areas, there's a section on virtual reality, which I was involved in, reverse engineering the brain, which is one important source of the algorithms and methods of intelligence. It will also give us new insight into ourselves and also to fixing the brain. Development of artificial intelligence, I mean, all that's in the report. Moving to new energy sources, based on these exponential progressions, health and medicine, developing a rapid response system for new biological viruses. We could, for example, sequence a virus. We can do that now in a day or two. And that's another example of acceleration. It took 5 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS in 31 days. We can sequence a virus now in 1 or 2 days. And we could very quickly create an RNA interference-based medication or a new vaccine technology that works on the antigens of the surface of a virus, and very quickly develop a response to a new biological virus, analogous to how quickly we develop a response to software viruses. And that's also in the plan. So I think this is a very progressive plan. I think it's consistent with my view that technology, particularly when we can understand the information processes, is exponential and not linear. And that makes a huge difference in perspective, and that is reflected in this report. So I'm very excited about this report. It really provides a blueprint or a vision for how technology can address the biggest problems we face in society.
We have time for one more. In the back.
Yeah, Michael Bradbury with Real Science. We're talking about engineering today. Isn't one of the grandest challenges for the 21st century getting engineering in the conversation with science and technology? Can you comment on that? But how this report is going to advance the discussion of engineering in a broader context?
I think that question is ready made for Chuck Vest.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting paid for, but absolutely. You know, sort of what I see happened over the last couple decades is that a reasonable understanding of what science is, and we kind of dropped the word engineering and started using technology. And my observation is that 90% of the public and the politicians and so forth automatically fill in information before technology. And even though I agree with Ray that almost everything's becoming IT, I think we do need to get the word engineering back into the vernacular. But at the same time, as I said earlier, we've started moving away, and you've heard it in everybody's comments, in Calestos's and in Bob Langer and in Ray and so forth, we've moved away from a simple view that science is about discovering facts about nature, and engineering is about designing and building things, and medicine is about healing people. And these things are all blending together now. And so, of course, my view of that is engineering sits in the middle and reaches out and spreads and pulls more in. So you get people like Bob Langer here, who's sort of originally classically trained as a chemical materials engineer. His big contributions, or a vast majority of them, have really been in things that influence our ability to improve human health. So it's a big challenge. I think we all need to get up every morning and say the word engineering and engineers a few times.
Chuck, weren't you head of
same way they are in China.
Chuck, weren't you head of a school called Massachusetts Institute of Technology?
That's correct. Anyway, I appreciate the question, and everybody use the word engineering every third time you write something.
And apropos that, the website that was mentioned is www.engineeringchallenges.org. The speakers will be available for some follow-up questions in the follow-up room afterwards, and thank you for coming.